Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that criticised Chris Williamson before it was fashionable to do so. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
This week, we're going to try and answer the question, what does global Britain actually mean? First of all, though, Steve, let's define our terms. When people talk about global Britain, what do they generally refer to?
The kind of the terminology around global Britain came about during the Brexit referendum. Essentially, it means, rather than Britain confining itself to one small, quote-unquote, part of the world in Europe, that we should be free-spirited buccaneers going out into the world, striking up trade deals with as many nations as we can. By focusing on Europe, we're limiting ourselves, and that we're missing out on potential growth and gains from engaging with other areas of the world, such as the US, Asia, in particular with China and Japan. It's essentially trying to say Britain can be more than it is, it just needs to be brave enough to take the leap into the dark.
And I think there were stats during the referendum campaign, weren't there, about how Britain does more trade with Ireland than it does with India or with China or something. So it's about saying, look, we've got all these big markets out here that we're somehow not accessing yet.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, the notion has been with this that somehow by being a part of Europe, we were limiting ourselves to being able to trade with these largely actually up and coming nations, because that's really the big thing here. When you look at a lot of the countries that are kind of being focused on all of this, a lot of them are BRIC or BRIC countries, or they are ones where there's been very fast economic growth or the potential for fast economic growth. Politicians obviously want to say, look, we can get a part of this pie.
BRIC countries aren't countries made of BRICS or having a lot of BRICS in them. They're Brazil, Russia, India, China.
Yeah.
Part of the global Britain thesis then is that we need to have free trade deals with the rest of the world. Except, as an EU member, Britain's already party to 40 free trade agreements with 70 countries. And if we do leave the EU without a deal on March the 29th, March the 29th is 26 days away, then we lose access to all of those free trade deals.
Absolutely. It's one of those interesting little inconsistencies in the Brexit narrative and the ideas behind it. The EU is, I believe, the largest trading bloc in the world. Actually, when you put the EU as a whole up against the US and China, the EU is very competitive with them in the economic stakes. As a result of that, by kind of banding together and under the banner of the European Union, European countries are able to get much better deals and actually kind of make inroads into countries that individually might try and, shall we say, exploit the weakness of a lone member state.
We're going to get to exploiting our weakness in a second, but before we do that, the government wanted... I mean, there's a contradiction here, I think, in government policy, because on the one hand, the government wanted these 40 trade deals replicated before Britain left the European Union and wanted that done as quickly as possible. However, the way they tried to do that was by getting Liam Fox to do it. So of those 40 trade agreements, we've managed to get 6 confirmed so far. Israel.
Okay.
The Palestinian Authority. Switzerland. The Faroe Islands. Eastern and Southern Africa, and Chile.
Not going to lie, that's not necessarily a list of economic powerhouses.
But then going on to, why has that not happened? I mean, partly Liam Fox,
yeah.
Obviously.
Liam Fox, a man who spent £100,000 on a podcast to get 8,500 views, 8,500 downloads of it.
We had about 12,000 downloads last year, so we are 150% more successful than the podcast that cost £100,000 at, I think, 0.18% of the cost.
Yeah.
If you want us to do a podcast for you, Liam Fox, that's absolutely fine. But it will include extra hatred of Phil Wallace. And probably of Brexit as well, actually.
Yeah.
And so the thing with... And as you say, the problem is partly Liam Fox. It's also partly that Britain does not have the leverage to get free trade deals on its own, as it would do in a bloc with 27 other EU countries. So when, for instance... The British government went with Japan and South Korea earlier this year to try and get a trade deal sorted, the Japanese wanted big concessions
yeah.
to Britain as part of putting in that trade deal. They wanted better terms. In fact, the Japanese government has now walked away from those talks because it turns out for the Japanese, no deal is better than a bad deal, whereas obviously that's not quite the same in the UK's case at the moment.
Given that Britain is going to be in this position where it can be exploited, you know, you'd think that could actually be as low as it can get. But actually, the biggest issue could easily be the fact that, you know, we're just not going to be very far up the far into the queue for a lot of nations to actually want to talk to. Yes, Britain is a wealthy country.
Yes,
Britain has got a lot of wealth and does a lot of trade, and there's a lot of benefit to trading with Britain. But if you've got a choice between cutting a deal with China, cutting a deal with the US, or cutting a deal with the EU, Britain's just not going to get much of a look in. And there's two reasons for that. One is that essentially every single kind of trade deal you do aligns you with one of the major kind of economic players in one form or another. And as I say, that's China, US, or Europe. Now, if you do a deal with Europe, then you're not going to, and you're adopting European standards or whatever, you're not doing that for the US and you're not doing that with China. And the same goes for the other combinations as well, which means Britain, who's got its own standards and its own things potentially under this kind of global Britain mindset, is nowhere, because nobody's going to adopt your standards or kind of talk to you because they're wanting a slice of the bigger pies elsewhere. And that's just the first problem. The second problem is because we're relatively small economically compared to those big blocks, there's only so much time that other countries are going to put developing trade deals. They've only got so many negotiators. They've only got, you know, so many hours in the day, in effect, or has only so much money to help move it along.
They actually have trade negotiators.
Yeah, I know.
Unlike
but essentially, you're going to end up in a situation where if they've got a choice to send people to a meeting with Liam Fox or send them to the EU or China or the US, well, they're going to choose them over us because, again, there's a bigger pie, which means just even getting started on a number of these trade deals is going to be delayed, let alone actually finishing them up.
Well, and you said Britain might be towards the back of the queue and low down the priority list for countries looking for trade deals. Barack Obama in the 2016 referendum famously said that the UK, if it left the EU, would be at the back of the queue for other trade deals. Donald Trump said, I think relatively soon after becoming president, that wasn't the case, that Britain was going to be pushed further up the priority list. Except this week, we've seen the first kind of opening gambit from the American government about what they would be looking for in a US-UK trade deal. Now, everyone was very shocked to discover that what that would involve is essentially American goods wanting to sell their chlorinated chicken over here, wanting farmers to lower their food standards and us to lower our food standards so we get in the rubbish American imports. And that's even before we start thinking about all the pharmaceutical companies that we want bits and bobs out of the NHS.
Yeah, like the NHS one is going to be the real killer for any kind of trade deal, because they're going to want to, you know, American companies are going to want to try and be able to provide services to the NHS in the same way that Bupa or Virgin do. Step aside the rights or wrongs of outsourcing things in the NHS, because that's a completely different conversation and not what this particular episode's about.
You centrist, you.
I know. The reality is these companies are a lot more vicious and a lot more And shall we say, a lot more likely to cut corners, actually, than their British counterparts in a lot of ways.
Certainly on the farmer side, because that's kind of been in the news this week, it would lead to a bit of a crash with Michael Gove's agenda as Environment Secretary, because Gove has made it reasonably clear that he wants to see UK farmers held to a higher standard of animal welfare, of farming regulations than the EU has currently after Brexit, not a lower one.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the interesting little things that kind of came out of Brexit, was that there was the notion that, oh yeah, we don't want to be held back in some areas by EU regulations and saying that we have to treat animals to this standard. I mean, that's not how EU regulations work. They don't say, this is the standard everything has to be. They say, this is the minimum standard that they have to be. And if you guys want to go further than that, good for you.
It's kind of stupid man's Thatcherism, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's this kind of somehow, this idea that government regulations are the enemy rather than the things that protect your drinking water from being contaminated or protect you from getting food poisoning, and somehow that every regulation is somehow there to stop business rather than save lives.
Yeah.
Mm. Trade. The final thing, I suppose, on trade deals before we go on to the second point is that other countries at the moment that have been looking for trade deals, places like India and Turkey, what both of those countries have indicated is that, yes, okay, British companies could get access into their markets. In return, what they would like to see, more immigration from Turkey and India into Britain. Now, obviously, there was a little bit during the Leave campaign in 2016 from people like Priti Patel, who essentially said we should end EU free movement so that we can get more visas for curry chefs from India, was her usual example. And there's a little bit of evidence, I think, to suggest that actually those from black and ethnic minority backgrounds voted Brexit in larger numbers than you'd expect, possibly because of reasons like that. But then the Leave campaign also made a very, very big issue of the fact, wrongly and incorrectly, that Turkey was going to join the EU. Therefore, you had these 8 billion Turks about to come into Britain.
I believe Nigel Farage quite literally implied that the entirety of the population of Turkey was going to move to the UK as part of the referendum campaign.
And therefore, that certainly goes against what people voted for 3 years ago. And I think although you can disagree to the extent to which immigration was a massive factor in the Leave result, it's certainly been part of May's rhetoric since.
So much of what is kind of like the guiding light almost and the one of the few consistencies you can see in Theresa May's government approach to things is that it's anti-immigration. Basically everything else in the Brexit negotiations has been sacrificed for the goal of being able to control our borders, quote unquote.
And in fact, Ivan Rogers was making this point with Der Spiegel this week, who used to be the UK ambassador to the EU, and said the thing you've got to understand, I think he was trying to Brits-blame Brexit to some very confused Germans who, in the words of the New York Times, don't really understand why we're sat in a room jabbering to ourselves while trying to blow our own kneecaps off.
He
made exactly that point, that the only thing you've got to understand about May is it's all been about trying to control immigration and restrict it.
Absolutely. But which presents you with a problem, right? Even outside of like the Brexit negotiations themselves, if most of the up-and-coming nations which you want to get these trade deals with are going to want, in some capacity, you know, looser immigration policy for their people, how do you square that circle? Everything that the Tories have been doing on this front is very basic anti-immigrant rhetoric. There's not and politics. There's nothing really nuanced about it from my understanding.
No, I think go home bands are very... No, I see what you mean. They're not very nuanced. No.
The Tories themselves aren't going to be able to kind of roll back on, because it will annoy their base, which means a number of these deals they're not going to be able to get, because fundamentally they're not going to be prepared to actually offer what our potential trading partners want.
So there's that. Also, then, there's the idea of essentially, and you've touched on this already, the idea of Brexit being a misunderstanding of geopolitics and what Britain's place in the world is. So Chris Gray, who's a really good blogger on Brexit, All Kind of Manners Brexit, had a very interesting post in January about this. Essentially, trade happens generally nowadays in big regional trade blocks. So obviously, the single market's the one Britain's in at the moment. Also, NAFTA and TPP as well, and I think it's the TPP that Britain would be trying to get access to with the Japan deal. I think I'm right in saying, though I could be wrong. And so in this kind of multipolar world where you've got, as you say, it's not quite the US being the dominant power, you've got Russia, China and America, and then all the bigger regional players like India and Iran, you need to be in one of those bigger regional trading blocks and have access to it.
So much of the kind of the global Britain narrative, in my opinion, is, I've always used the term kind of, and I think I used it earlier in this podcast, buccaneering, as the kind of the notion behind it. It's Errol Flynn trade policy, where you can kind of go swinging on the chandeliers to have for having high seas adventures almost, so that you can land and bring back the wealth and the treasure from these far off lands to the British people.
Or just steal it like Francis Drake did.
Exactly, yeah. Fundamentally, that's not how the world works. Fundamentally, whilst Britain absolutely punches above its weight in terms of its size and its economic capacity, its military strength. You know, we are still a global powerhouse in a lot of ways compared to most nations on this planet. But we're not big enough on our own to be able to have the kind of impact the buccaneering Brexiteers seem to think we can have. There's an awful lot of kind of talk in some areas where we kind of talk about how the fall of empire kind of has influenced like Britain's kind of view of itself, and how we've maybe not come to terms with it in a lot of ways, especially when it comes to England. There's just so much of this seems to be kind of almost like trying to harken back to those mercantilist days where somehow, because we're British, we can make people kowtow to what we want. Now, that's absolutely possible with gunboat diplomacy. It's not possible with actual diplomacy and free trade deals.
Don't talk to Gavin Williamson about gunboat diplomacy either, but I mean, the idea that somehow Britain should be punching above its weight, I always find quite a curious one, because the whole point is, I suppose, with boxing is boxers don't punch above their weight. If a boxer punches above its weight, he gets beaten up very quickly, very often.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing with trying to focus on Asia, and Jeremy Hunt's been in Japan and China, and forgetting the nationality of his wife, and the kind of Southeast Asia, and kind of pivoting there, I suppose, is partly it ignores the fact that we need to be in a single market because of those just-in-time supply chains. And we're seeing the reason why a lot of JLR, obscure Birmingham reference, and other car manufacturers are getting very, very worried now about Brexit, is because Britain might be out of these just-in-time supply chains, which hasn't really been addressed. But the other thing is that you do more trade with the countries you're closest to just because of sheer geographical proximity. In the same way, I will do probably more of my shops at the little co-op 5 minutes down the road, even though that's more expensive than the supermarket half-hour walk away. I buy more there because it's nearer and more convenient. It's the same with international trade. And I think it's a misunderstanding of the Brexiters to think that, as you say, somehow we can do what Francis Drake did and go on a ship and fly around and sail around the world and come back.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in some ways the success of globalisation as a term and an understanding and as a framework for how policy is made and all of that is largely kind of responsible for this, because they seem to think that, oh, it's a small world now. And, you know, compared to the old days, or even 20, 30 years ago, it absolutely is.
I think you'll find the world is the same size it was 20, 30 years ago.
I meant metaphorically. You know, you can fly anywhere at the drop of a hat. You know, data travels from one side of the world to the other in the blink of an eye. It's absolutely insane how much the world has changed. But just because things can happen more quickly doesn't mean, as you say, the fundamental kind of basics of human behaviour have changed. The notion that the world has gotten smaller, I think, has kind of fed into this global Britain Brexiteer narrative, because by the world getting smaller, they think somehow that Britain has still stayed the same size in comparison. And again, punching above our weight comes into it, because we're able to kind of step up because we're Great Britain. Emphasis on the great. And we can get this done.
I do wonder if some of that is a little bit ahistorical as well, though, because I think it was before the First World War, I think it was John Maynard Keynes, I think it was, writing about the world before 1914. Mm-hmm. And he says that it was a world in which you're able to pick your phone up and order something and it would be delivered halfway across the world and arrive at your house the following morning. Now, admittedly, he's talking about maybe the telephone, the telegraph, and a very, very efficient postal system rather than the digital economy. But I think actually, in terms of has the world sped up, it's not actually sped up a huge amount, actually,
depends
comparatively.
It depends on what it is you're looking at, really. So when it comes to data and information, it absolutely has. When you're talking physical goods, toss up.
Yeah, but talking communication, it was a much bigger change in the 19th century when you go from it taking weeks to get a message over to America to minutes with the telegraph than it is from a few minutes to a few seconds.
Oh, absolutely. But I think it's, again, boils down to the kind of like the quantity that goes out as well. It's not just about the overall kind of time for a single message, but the number of messages that can go out as well.
If we finish off then in terms of global Britain, and again, you've touched on this already about our diplomatic power, about the soft power that we've got. Yeah. And the idea, certainly when people talk about Britain punching above its weight, as a global power, it's generally about the soft power which we have. And there was a really interesting report that came out a couple of weeks ago by the UNA, so the United Nations Association in the UK, who did a report on Britain's influence in the UN. And they found a few interesting things. So one of them is that Britain still has considerable influence in the UN. It does still set a lot of the agenda in the UN. And civil servants are seen as being very professional, being a very, very good diplomatic skill, which is nice. Only thing is that is very changeable. This report was written by a few academics, and a lot of them were questioning the idea of the UK having a permanent member in the UN Security Council after Brexit, because they essentially seem to think that the UK's influence and clout in the UN is kind of declining relatively at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much all of our influence currently is going to be because we hold that seat on the Security Council. The report essentially says that in the General Assembly, really, we don't have that much clout anymore. And any clout we do have is the result of our commitment currently to the 0.7% of GDP being spent on international aid, because I think we're pretty much one of the few countries that's actually hitting it.
I think it's 6 or 8 countries in the world at the moment. Yeah.
Which, you know, puts us in quite good stead with a lot of smaller nations who you know, utilise that aid. They see that as a good sign that we're actually on their side in some capacity. But that on its own isn't necessarily going to be enough. And ironically, again, you know, Global Britain wanting to kind of go out there, make trade deals, talk to other countries on a one-to-one level so we can, like, bond and get trade happening. Well, the one thing that a lot of the Brexiteers and the Tory right want to get rid of is the 0.7% GDP commitment for international development aid.
Indeed, there are a lot of politicians who are jumping on the bandwagon of the Daily Mail, I think it was, originally trying to get rid of this 0.7%. And again, it's just a misunderstanding, I suppose, of how you influence the world. Mm-hmm. There's just a real big perception among diplomats there at the moment that we've shot ourselves in the foot over Brexit, which might be news or not to some of you. So recently, diplomatic efforts in Syria and Yemen were led by Sweden and the Netherlands rather than Britain. I suppose with a lot of these things, it's all that perception's quite important as well. And this kind of perception that our influence is dwindling, we're a little bit of a laughing stock. A lot of people who, the diplomats who were interviewed by the academics, also framed it as this idea of the UK's influence declining and dwindling globally over a longer period of time. And again, it goes back to what you were saying earlier. I think it's the Dean Acheson quote, isn't it, about Britain losing an empire but not yet finding a role, and then Suez. And I think it's being framed as a kind of, like, maybe the...
It's the midlife crisis.
Yeah, or the dying of the light, I suppose. So what's really interesting are a couple of case studies it gives of the UK finding it difficult to achieve its goals in the UN since Brexit. Just briefly, one of them is Somalia. So the UK played a role in a kind of a peacekeeping mission in Somalia. And essentially, it was able to say, right, we need this to happen. We're going to achieve it through the UN, and we're going to get the EU to fund it. Now, what's happened since is, essentially, the EU capped the funding of the mission to Somalia in January 2016 over UK objections. That essentially means the UK's had to try and find more money to support that mission. So rather than it being the EU funding that mission, it's the UK having to fund that mission. So that's kind of one example. There's another example it gives is about the Chagos Islands. So there's a dispute between the UK and Mauritius over those islands. And we lost a UN General Assembly vote by 94 votes to 15 in June 2017 on the jurisdiction of those islands. Now, we did the interesting thing for the UK was our failure to not get the support of EU member states. So only 4 EU member states supported the UK, the UN. Most abstained, and we only got the support of America. That was the only permanent Security Council member to support us in that claim. And so it's this idea that essentially the fact that our influence is declining in the EU after Brexit means we're not able to get the support of those EU states in UN votes like that. So the final one as well is, in again in November 2017, the UK failed to get a British judge re-elected to the International Court of Justice. And that was the first time we didn't have a judge in the ICJ in the 71 years it's existed. Sir Jeremy Greenstock, who I think used to be our permanent representative to the UN, said the UK shouldn't have lost the vote. But the perception was, and this might sound familiar, essentially the UK was too distracted to try and campaign. We hadn't been able to campaign as hard on this vote as we usually would be able to, and so have been able to lose it. And so there's lots of different scenarios in which actually we are struggling just on a day-by-day basis to campaign for change in the UN and advance our interests because of Brexit over a multiplicity of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also kind of shows just a lack of understanding of how we should be trying to make Brexit actually a success if we're going to go through with it. Because really, if we are going to separate ourselves from the EU, we need to be best buds with pretty much everybody in some form, which is also the way that you then get them on board for your aims.
No, and actually, that's a very good point, is that actually we are less willing to criticise China now because we need their support for a trade deal. It means you're not able to exert your kind of moral authority and criticise regimes like China, like Saudi Arabia, because you might need them further down the line. Mm-hmm. And I suppose Global Britain at the moment is just a rhetorical slogan. It doesn't mean anything. Oh, God, we're really screwed, aren't we?
Yeah, bring a coat.
Okay, on that note, we have a website, notenoughchampagne.com, available in all countries. That's Global Britain. Stick that in your pipe and smoke it, Liam Fox. We also have a Facebook page, facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram. Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. My Twitter handle is @paperbackrioter.
I'm @acousticradical.
Happy plotting.